I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Please support our independent journalism at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar. Thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think the word war criminal should not be thrown around in the domestic debate. It's a shameful, it's a reflection on the people who use it.
Henry Kissinger has died at the age of 100. To many in the Washington establishment, Kissinger is hailed as one of the nation's most influential and famous diplomats. But around the world, from Chile to East Timor, Bangladesh to Cambodia and Laos, Henry Kissinger is remembered as a war criminal whose actions led to massacres, coups, and the deaths of millions. We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin, author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman.
So Kissinger's trajectory from Cambodia, from being the architect of this secret campaign to bomb a country the United States wasn't at war with, to the state we are in now, governed by a national security state, is what I think is most instructive about Kissinger's life and most important about him, other than describing him as a war criminal, which he is.
But first, as the truce in Gaza is extended another day, we speak with Avril Benoit, executive director of Doctors Without Borders, and human rights lawyer Raji Sarani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. He's now left Gaza. He'll join us from Cairo. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's agreed to extend its truce with Hamas for a seventh day to facilitate the exchange of captives. The extension was announced just minutes before it was set to expire Thursday morning, prolonging a reprieve for Gaza's 2.3 million residents after 47 days of relentless attacks by Israel spawned a massive humanitarian crisis. On Wednesday, Hamas released 16 hostages, 10 Israelis, 4 Thai nationals, and 2 Russian-Israeli citizens. In exchange, Israel released another 30 Palestinian women and children prisoners, many of them jailed indefinitely without charge under Israel's administrative detention policy. On Wednesday, Hamas said its youngest Israeli hostage, 10-month-old Kafir Bibas, was killed in an Israeli bombing alongside his mother and 4-year-old brother. If those deaths are confirmed, the hostages join some 15,000 people killed by Israel's assault on Gaza since the October 7th Hamas attacks. 2/3 of the dead are women and children. Also on Wednesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said it discovered the decomposing remains of 5 premature Palestinian babies left to die after Israeli forces ordered medical staff to evacuate and blocked access to the intensive care unit at the Al-Nasser Pediatric Hospital in North Gaza. Shocking footage filmed by the Dubai-based outlet Al-Mashad shows the babies still attached to ventilation and intravenous tubes as they lay lifeless in their hospital beds. Rights groups are calling for an international investigation. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli gunfire killed a 21-year-old Palestinian man and wounded 4 others as they gathered outside Ofer prison awaiting the release of Palestinian prisoners. Meanwhile, 2 Palestinian children who were shot dead by Israeli forces during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp Wednesday have been identified. 15-year-old Basil Suleiman Abu Awafa died in a hospital after he was shot in the chest. And 8-year-old Adam Al-Ghul was shot in the head as he ran from Israeli forces in a killing that was captured on video. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said Israeli soldiers blocked medics from approaching the camp to tend to the wounded. Israeli police say 3 Israelis were killed and several others wounded Thursday morning when a pair of Palestinian gunmen opened fire at a bus stop on the outskirts of Jerusalem. The attackers were shot and killed by two off-duty soldiers and an armed civilian. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has pledged to resume Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip once Israel's ceasefire agreement with Hamas expires.
After completing this stage of the return of our hostages, will Israel go back to fighting? My answer is an unequivocal yes. There is no situation in which we do not go back to fighting until the end. This is my policy. The entire cabinet is behind it.
Netanyahu's comments came after Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, threatened to dissolve the coalition government led by Netanyahu if Israel halts its bombardment of Gaza. Here in New York, hundreds of peaceful protesters led by a group of interfaith organizers gathered in Midtown Manhattan to demand an end to Israel's assault on Gaza and its occupation of Palestinian lands on the occasion of the annual Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting ceremony. Hordes of police officers were deployed to the event as activists ultimately gathered in front of the nearby News Corp building to rally. This is Nardine Kiswani of the group Within Our Lifetime.
We stand here on the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people in solidarity with Jerusalem's 13 official churches and the entire municipality.
That's Nardine Kiswani outside Fox. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., progressive Congress members Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman joined a group of activists, politicians, and celebrities who were on day three of their hunger strike to demand a permanent ceasefire. This is Congressmember Tlaib speaking at their nightly White House vigil.
When this pause and the violence expires, all I keep thinking about is asking my colleagues, how many more lives? How many more lives will be enough? How many more children need to be killed? How many more families have to be traumatized and torn apart? There is nothing humanitarian, my friends, about giving innocent civilians a few days of rest before they are bombed again.
Earlier in the day, House members voted nearly unanimously to pass a resolution equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, a framing which has driven the backlash against anyone who's critical of the Israeli government. Only Congressmember Thomas Massie voted against the measure. Congressmember Tlaib voted present. Employees and job seekers continue to report retaliatory action for speaking out against the conflict. Georgetown Law School graduate Jinan Chahadi says she had a job offer with the prominent law firm Foley and Lardner rescinded over her support for Palestinian rights on social media after she was interrogated by the law firm's partners.
They framed my advocacy for Palestine as supporting terrorism, and I was singled out as one of the only visibly Arab Muslim woman associates in the law firm nationwide. Today, I'm speaking in defiance of the surge of attacks we have been seeing against Palestinians and their allies, from the murder of six-year-old Wadi Al-Fayoumi, to the shooting of three Palestinian students in Vermont, to severe attacks on employees and associates like myself who speak up for Palestine. However, the more of us that speak up, the more power we have. So today, I'm not only speaking up, but I'm fighting back and pursuing legal action.
Palestine Legal says it's received more than 700 requests for support from advocates for Palestinian rights since October 7th. That's triple the number the group reported for the entire year last year. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, the architect of a highly militarized U.S. foreign policy under Presidents Nixon and Ford, has died at the age of 100. In the late 60s and 70s, Kissinger oversaw a massive expansion of the war in Vietnam and the secret bombings of Laos and Cambodia, where as many as 150,000 civilians were killed. In Latin America, Kissinger supported dictatorship that used torture and murder as tools of political repression, from Bolivia to Uruguay to Argentina. In Chile, Kissinger helped topple the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende, ushering 17 years of dictatorship under General Augusto Pinochet. In 1975, Kissinger and President Ford met with the Indonesian dictator General Suharto, giving him the go-ahead to invade East Timor, which led to the killing of a third of the Timorese population. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Greg Grandin once estimated Kissinger's actions may have led to the deaths of up to 4 million people. After headlines, Professor Grandin will join us to discuss Henry Kissinger's life and legacy. The U.S. Department of Justice has charged an Indian national with plotting to assassinate a prominent Sikh separatist leader living in New York City after federal agents allegedly thwarted a murder-for-hire plot. Federal prosecutors in Manhattan say 52-year-old Nikhil Gupta has been arrested in the Czech Republic pending extradition to the United States after an unnamed Indian government employee recruited him last May to carry out the assassination. Gupta allegedly offered a $100,000 bounty to a hitman who turned out to be an undercover DEA agent. The plot allegedly targeted Gurpatwant Singh Panum, a U.S. citizen, lawyer, and spokesperson for the organization Six for Justice, which advocates for an independent state for Sikhs in northern India. Gupta's arrest comes just 2 months after Canada's government said agents of India's government, led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, were directly involved in the assassination of the prominent Canadian Sikh separatist leader, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, in June. And ex-CEO Elon Musk lashed out during a New York Times event Wednesday when asked about recent advertiser boycotts over Musk's reposting of anti-Semitic content.
If somebody's going to try to blackmail me with advertising, blackmail me with money, go f*** yourself.
But
go f*** yourself. Is that clear?
F yourself, Musk said repeatedly. Over 100 brands have halted their ads on X, formerly known as Twitter, which stands to lose $75 million in ad sales by the end of the year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Israel has agreed to extend its truce with Hamas for a seventh day to facilitate the exchange of captives. The extension was announced just minutes before it was set to expire on Thursday morning, prolonging a reprieve for Gaza's 2.3 million residents after 47 days of relentless attacks by Israel spawned a massive humanitarian crisis. On Wednesday, Hamas released 16 hostages. In exchange, Israel released another 30 Palestinian women and child prisoners. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, two Palestinian children were shot dead by Israeli forces during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp on Wednesday. 15-year-old Basil Suleiman Abu Al-Wafa died in a hospital after he was shot in the chest. An 8-year-old Adam Al-Ghul was shot in the head as he ran from Israeli forces in a killing captured on video. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said Israeli soldiers blocked medics from reaching the camp to treat the wounded. In Khan Yunis, in the south of Gaza, Doctors Without Borders surgeon Dr. Hafez Abu Khusa described how his hospital is overwhelmed.
That we see, they are the majority of patients, they are female and children. But what hurt me a lot when I see a child, an innocent child, injured, and he needs a major surgery, he lost his limb, and he's the last child, he's the only remnant of his family. And when he woke up from anesthesia, he asked to see his family. So this is really a heartbreaking situation. The crisis that we face here is the lack of supplies, the lack of instruments. To the hospital, in normal days, there's 300 patients. Now it's more than 1,000 patients. A patient, they are homeless because many of them are refugees within Gaza. And the other people, they have their houses were destroyed. They don't have the access to potable water. There's a lack of food, a lack of extremity. And some of them just get out from their houses with the clothes that they are wearing. We know that we are in danger anytime, but we will keep doing the same.
For more, we're joined by Avril Benoit, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. Welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what is happening right now in Gaza. I mean, as we are broadcasting, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken is meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, and he just met with Netanyahu. There is a ceasefire. Not clear it was going to be extended even one more day. Minutes before the end of that ceasefire, it was announced it would continue. What have you learned about the devastation?
Well, thanks for having me. From the medical humanitarian perspective, what we have seen from the beginning after the appalling attack on October 7th has been a collective punishment of the people in Gaza. And that's why you see such a disproportionate number of civilians killed. The devastation on the hospitals is near complete. There are a few hospitals in the north that are really not much more than shelters right now, with still medical personnel trying to stay with patients, but they have no more equipment, they have no electricity, they have no water. They're holed up, and it's a very high-risk evacuation route. We know from our own experience of our team that was stuck there with their families after having made the decision for the medical doctors to stay with some of the patients in the hospitals, that they were subjected to crossfire. A couple of the members of the evacuation group, the family members, were killed in that. Our vehicles were destroyed, the ones that we were intending to use to be able to evacuate these staff and families after they retreated from what seemed to be imminent risk of death that proved to be fatal in the end. And so what we're seeing is this surge of patients in the south. As you just heard, hospitals from the beginning have been completely overwhelmed, but now they've got patients who really require much more complex medical care. They require really referral, ideally a medical evacuation in a safe way to a third country, for example, where they can receive the level of care that will save their lives and prevent further damage. Just to mention another thing, because of the lack of antibiotics, medicine, wound dressing equipment, we have a very high risk of high numbers of people dying of infections. And that is something that should never happen under international humanitarian law, the norms of war. People should have access to medical care in a conflict like this. And that is just not being guaranteed in terms of the way this war is being conducted.
Can I ask you if you've heard about this report of El Nasser Pediatric Hospital in northern Gaza and the premature babies, five of them discovered the remains of the babies. The reports were that they were left to die after Israeli forces blocked access to the intensive care unit.
I don't have the details on that. I'm sorry. What we do know is that it was a harrowing decision for the medical staff when ordered to evacuate, and knowing that sometimes you're only given a couple of hours, which is completely unacceptable. Even in the context of this pause, this truce, which we certainly hope will continue and become an actual ceasefire, it's very complicated to transfer a patient that is in a vulnerable state, in a machine that no longer has any electricity. As you probably know, the lack of fuel has meant it's near impossible to run ambulances. And because of the violence, all these checkpoints where it seems that people are waiting for hours and hours. You can imagine you've got people who are transferred from an intensive care unit, stuffed into an ambulance because it's one of the only ones running, and then at a checkpoint they're stopped for up to 7 hours, and then there's violence and they feel they have to retreat. It's a very harrowing, high-risk kind of thing to organize. And that's one of the reasons that we're calling for this killing to stop, for there to be a proper ceasefire, and furthermore, for there to be medical evacuations so that people can receive the care they need in a safe way, with, of course, the right to return if they so wish, and then also for there to be unconditional humanitarian aid that is allowed to enter, because we know people are in places where the aid cannot reach, and they cannot reach the hospitals. They don't feel it's safe, and so they are at risk of dying and suffering lifelong consequences if they don't receive the medical care right away.
And Avril, could you speak about the during this pause, how much medical equipment, supplies, medicine, as you were speaking about earlier, the acute shortage, which many people have mentioned, how much medication is coming in, medication and equipment is coming in during this pause into Gaza?
The specifics are unclear, to be perfectly honest. We see that every day there are a certain number of trucks. They move at a snail's pace. What we would really like to see, of course, is for that to be faster and of greater volume. Before this conflict, before October 7th, there were 500 trucks that would cross daily into Gaza, and that was during a blockade. So not enough. The hospitals were already at a deficit of the equipment that they needed, of the replenishing supplies. All the stocks were always threadbare. And so then compounded with the fact that we have an estimated 30 to 35,000 wounded people, not to mention those that are now coming in with fevers, gastrointestinal situations, acute watery diarrhea. Maybe it's cholera. We don't know because we don't have the testing facilities and labs available to check. What we're seeing with this truce is that there is no way to be able to support the hospitals that continue to stand. Of course, many of them have been damaged in the fighting. They have been attacked systematically. The World Health Organization has been tracking this. And for us, this is such an obvious violation of international humanitarian law, to attack hospitals, to attack medical staff, to kill them while they're at the bedside of patients, and our own colleagues have been killed, and to just go after these facilities as if there's some excuse that is legitimate when it's not, and there's no evidence that's been offered to really prove that they should be targets. So really nothing to substantiate that at all. They are protected spaces. And so the truce has allowed perhaps some stocks to go in for us to facilitate, to do some movements, to check on some hospitals and clinics to see what their stocks are like. But what you really needed was to pre-position everything, to have it already in place at the starting blocks in a warehouse, ready to be distributed to the places that need it most, that still have medical staff. And that wasn't done because of the total siege over the last many weeks.
And Avril, I'm not sure, I'm sure you've heard that the World Health Organization earlier this week warned that more people in Gaza could die from disease than have already died from the bombing. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, well, certainly I mentioned infections earlier. When you have children coming in who have more than 50% of their bodies burned from explosions. They are, in the best case scenario, in the fully equipped hospital with all the means to control the infection. Really, it's a life or death situation. So now we have so many of these children that we cannot treat properly. We don't even have the proper gauze in the stocks to be able to do it. The other thing that the World Health Organization was pointing out, which is entirely plausible, is this whole question of dehydration. So young children, infants, are coming in severely dehydrated. And where is the water? Since the siege began, this is one of the things that this collective punishment has homed in on, to say, we're not going to give you access to water or food or medicines, all the things that are needed just to stay alive. So that's a huge problem right now. And then you just think of the people with chronic illnesses, and this is always a concern for us. Somebody who's on heart medication, or they have diabetes, they have any number of chronic illnesses, think of all the cancer patients. Where are they supposed to go to replenish? The hospital system that is barely functioning at all in the South, for example, their focus is on the severely wounded that are coming in, trying to keep people alive, patch them up, do the amputations really quickly, not in the proper way even to allow for prosthetic devices after. They're just trying to do the most, triage very urgently. And the ones who need safe place to give birth, the ones who need their heart medication, the children who are severely dehydrated, and there's nowhere really to look after them in a hospital like that, these are the ones that are likely to be the other casualties of this war, not only the ones who were killed by the direct violence that is seemingly affecting civilians so much more than anyone else.
Avril Benoit, if you can talk about Netanyahu's threat to in resuming the bombardment. You've got Blinken, who reportedly is urging more surgical strikes, but they're talking about bombarding the South. This is where they forced, what is it, a million Gazans, Palestinians, to go from the north. So talk about what this would mean if this temporary ceasefire ends.
It's a horror show for us. Just think about it. A third of the injured people already were injured in the South, which was the place that everyone was told to go. That was the place you were supposed to leave the North, go to the South, and then they got killed there. So for us, this is the worst, because what we have is, on the one side, the talk of we would like humanitarian law to be respected. We would like civilians to be considered, limit the collateral damage of civilians. And yet, what we have seen time and again is there are no consequences evident for not doing that. And so we have, with the looming end of this truce, and it seems not enough political will to really have a ceasefire, what we would regard as a kind of talking one thing, but no consequences. So we can tell the Israeli forces, the Netanyahu government, please try to limit the killing of civilians, start doing that. But we're not really seeing any consequences if they don't. And we do know that the United States is providing billions in aid, its military aid. And so, you know, it seems that that aid could well be used with no consequences to violate international norms, the Geneva Conventions, international humanitarian law. And for us, that's just unacceptable.
And finally, Avril Benoit, MSF International President Christos Christou posted this update on Tuesday that while he was visiting the MSF team at the Khalil Suleiman Hospital in Jenin, the Israeli army conducted an incursion on the refugee camp.
Yes, and one of the most difficult things about
We're going to play a clip of Christou right now.
Sounds good.
It's been already 2.5 hours that we are trapped in our hospital here in Jenin, while the Israeli forces are operating in another incursion in Jenin camp. There is no way for any of the injured patients to reach the hospital, and there's no way for us to reach these people. There's nothing worse for a doctor to know that there are people there needing our care and they cannot get it.
So, Avril Benoit, if you could comment on that and also the fact that two children were killed in Jenin just today.
Yes, well, as Dr. Christou, our international president, said, if people cannot access a facility in the West Bank, already you can see the grave concern that we have. Under humanitarian law, anyone should be able to reach a hospital. And to have a hospital surrounded, blocked, so that no one can actually bring their injured children, bring their wounded to that hospital, for us, is a complete outrage. It's been happening systematically in Gaza. And for us to now see it elsewhere is something that we as an international community should never accept. And that is one of the reasons that we are speaking so loudly and in a united voice with the humanitarian aid agencies for a ceasefire, a proper ceasefire, to stop the killing, stop the siege, and allow aid to come in unconditionally and for the people to be helped, saved, and to be able to resume their lives in some shape or form.
We want to thank you, Avril Benoit, for joining us. This ceasefire we will see goes day by day. Those children in Jenin killed yesterday. Avril Benoit is executive director of Doctors Without Borders. Coming up, we'll be speaking with the acclaimed Gazan human rights attorney, Raji Sarani, director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. He's going to be joining us from Cairo. After his house was bombed in northern Gaza, we will find out about his journey south. Then we'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin about the death of Henry Kissinger. Stay with us.
Bye.
The Stranger Cared About Me by Joa Hashafani. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue our coverage of Gaza, we're joined by Raji Surani.